Hey, it's Wolfman Mac from Wolfman Mac's Nightmare Cinema. We're hanging out at the Haunted Winery here in Warren, Michigan with the good folks from Ghostly Talk. Ooh, this place is creepy, man, but nowhere near as creepy as Wolfman Mac's Nightmare Cinema. It's a haunted drive-in, babies, and you know what we do there? We host classic B-horror and sci-fi movies, just like the ones you grew up with when you was a kid. And it's at Wolfman Mac's Nightmare Cinema right now, hosting on public access TV all over Metro Detroit. But guess what, kiddies? It's coming to you, and all you gotta do is have a computer. Just go to Wolfman Max Nightmare Cinema. It's nightmarecinema.com. We'll be broadcasting the show real soon, right from the website. Stay tuned. It's Wolfman Mac, Nightmare Cinema. Bye.
Nightmare Cinema.
The Women's International Study of the Paranormal is coming to Bentonsport, Iowa, May 23rd through the 25th. With guest speakers such as Patrick Burns, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Mary Ellen Hammack, Lisa DeWallaby, Rose Pressy, and many more. The Women's International Study of the Paranormal is hosted by Donna LaCroix of Ghost Hunters International, Jackie Carpenter and Elizabeth Corey of International Paranormal Research Association, Inc., Christy Hinkle of Celestial Paranormal Research and Investigations, Marie Cipriano of Southern New England Paranormal, and Haunting Existence Radio. Go to www.wispexpo.com to register now. The Women's International Study of the Paranormal is now accepting vendors to display their items at the conference. Also, we are offering special packages for new sponsors. All inquiries should be sent to info@wispexpo.com.
Gonna lay with the ghost by my side. Let the birds take.
Have a night, have a night. In the dark, have a night, have a night.
Starting Sundays, Ghostly Talk, right after Hearst, Darkness on the Edge of Town, Mondays, Haunting Existence Radio, Tuesday nights, Make sure you check in on Mrs. Radio at night to get your paranormal fix.
This must be where pies go when they die.
Listening to Ghostly Talk.
You there, Doug?
I'm here. I was confused for a moment.
I'm anyway. Like, what are you confused about? It's the wrong time to be confused!
It's how my weekend is going. It's about to get better. Because Michael Cremo is on the cutting edge of science and culture issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national television show, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audience a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. The website is www.mcremo.com, which of course is permanently linked up already.
Oh, it has been.
And ghostlytalk.com because he's returning. Welcome back, Michael.
Great to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while since we had you on the show.
Way too long.
Yeah, it's been way too long. I remember last time we had you on, I think we left that interview just like with our heads smoking, literally. Like, oh my God, that's a whole lot of information taken in 1 hour. But we did, and that's why we wanted to have you come back. We didn't really touch on this the last time we talked, though, and that's the book that you put together called Human Devolution. And I think we wanted to start maybe talking about that tonight a little bit. Can we get this like a brief idea of you know, we'll start with a brief idea, and I guess we can just run on that as far as what the book's about. And this is a big book too. There's a lot of stuff going on here. But can you give us just a little underbelly of what this, you know, what the idea of the book is?
Yeah, sure. It's a follow-up to my book, Forbidden Archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
In Forbidden Archaeology, I presented lots of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity. This is archaeological evidence showing that human beings have existed on Earth for tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. So, of course, this evidence contradicts the current scientific theories of human origins.
Mm-hmm.
And after that book came out, people started asking me, well, if you don't agree with the current scientific theory that human beings like us came into existence about 100,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors, then where do you think we came from? So human devolution is my answer to that question. Basically, I say we didn't evolve up from matter, as most scientists now believe. Rather, we have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness in the cosmos. I say before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now, today, many scientists are going to say that a human being or any other living thing is just a combination of the ordinary chemical elements, the ones like iron and phosphorus and carbon. You know, we're just a very complex organization of molecules, and there's nothing more to a human being than that. But what I propose in this book, Human Devolution, is that if we look very carefully at all the evidence that comes to us from various fields of science, we'll see it's more logical to say that a human being is made of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is, but beyond that, there is the subtle mind element, which has some very unusual powers like telepathy and psychokinesis and things like that. And then beyond that subtle mental body, there's the pure conscious self, which can exist independent of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what the book is about, showing that that conscious self had to have a source. It was, if that source is to be found on some level of pure consciousness, and that's where we come from, really. Mm-hmm. We haven't evolved up from matter, but down from pure consciousness, or spirit, if mm-hmm. you like that word.
Interesting, because we all are told that there was primordial soup.
Yeah.
And things were oozing around, and a couple of atoms banged into each other or something. And
said, hey, let's make a human.
And and whammo, all of a sudden, we, you know, things started growing, and, you know, we...
It was a long process.
Yeah, it took millions of years. And
yeah,
and
yeah,
so
I think I've seen that in the supermarket, primordial soup.
It's $6.99
a can. Put it on your stove and just leave it there for a few million years, and you get some pretty strange stuff.
Yeah, it's unlike Twinkies, you know, Twinkies you could leave for 8 million years,
yeah.
Nothing would grow on it, nothing would eat it. but you know, the primordial soup, I mean, you know, we're taught this thing. And then, of course, as soon as you start looking into things like you do, Michael, and reading on, you know, spirituality of any kind, you learn that there's got to be more. There just has to be
absolutely
more to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a little more seriously on this question of, you know, life self-organizing from chemicals. I mean, this is something we see repeated in every textbook. It's, you know, if you turn on PBS, Nova, you know, television programs like that, you'll see it stated all the time as if it were a demonstrated scientific fact. But the real fact is, no scientist today who believes in that idea can tell us exactly which chemicals combined in exactly which way to form exactly which first living thing. So really, that idea that life self-organized from chemicals is a belief. It's a very widely and strongly held belief among scientists, but it's not a demonstrated, proven scientific fact. And until somebody actually is able to, you know, to prove it in some demonstrable way, I think we have to remain open to alternatives. And, I mean, especially I think we have to remain open to the alternative that there might be something more to life than just chemicals.
Yeah.
That there's more to it than that. And I think we actually look at the history of science. See, what we get in most textbooks, you know, you go to high school and you go to college or university, and you get a history of science that has been completely sanitized. All the good stuff has been taken out, really. You're just left with this very dull idea that ordinary matter is the only thing that exists, and it's the only thing worthy of study. But that actually ignores the true history of physics.
Mm-hmm.
There's what I would call a hidden history of physics. For example, Pierre and Marie Curie, yeah, they were husband and wife. They were both given Nobel Prizes for their work in discovering radium early in the 20th century. They're kind of a hero and heroine of science, especially Marie Curie, because she's one of the few very prominent women scientists. But you read about them in every textbook about how they discovered radium. What you don't read is that they were heavily involved in psychical research into the paranormal. They were part of a group of 20 prominent European scientists, including 5 Nobel Prize winners, who were conducting such research in Paris early in the 20th century. And this group did 2 years of experiments with an Italian medium named Eusebia Palladino. This woman, she had some very unusual powers in the realm of telekinesis, mind over matter. So this group of scientists performed these experiments, and they didn't take place in somebody's dark living room, which is the usual kind of preconception that people have.
Mm-hmm.
These experiments took place in a psychological research institute in Paris, and they took place under carefully controlled conditions. On one occasion, the medium was sitting in a chair in the laboratory. Marie Curie, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, was holding her hands. Other scientists were holding her feet. And meanwhile, in one of these experiments, Pierre Curie, her husband, another Nobel Prize winning physicist, saw a large table floating about 3 feet off the ground in the middle of the laboratory in broad daylight under what he called perfect conditions of observation. So, to me, you know, that kind of evidence shows there's something more than chemicals. It shows there's a subtle mind element associated with a human organism that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain by our current laws of physics.
Well, there's, you know, I'm familiar with a lot of the development of, or the history, I should say, of spiritualism and the great, you know, mediums of the past. You know, there's like a lot of them. But what happens is when these folks did these things, you know, they did it in under scientific scrutiny. One of the things that I wasn't aware of, Michael, was that the Curies were involved in this. That's
well,
news
yes,
to me. I
hadn't
studied that.
Completely edited out of the whole scientific history.
It's also I mean maybe it's mentioned in some of my books, well, some of my old books, but it's it was pretty much I maybe my books are leaning toward more the spiritualism movement, which was the I'm sure it went hand in hand because that attracted notable figures of the time as well, but and scientists too, but yeah. not so much psychological laboratory kind of conditions. They were more in people's homes or, you know,
in the dark living rooms, like you said, Mike.
They were in the dark living rooms, and they were,
yeah.
or sometimes in things built in universities and things like that, but they were, you know, kept
they are mostly in
dark
situation.
And things like that. But yeah. but with Pierre Curie saying, these are perfect conditions, and I saw this, that's a pretty...
Well, not
bold
just him,
statement.
A whole group of scientists signed documents saying the phenomena were true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's one of those things that sort of edited out of the history of physics. But, you know, it's interesting. Once I was giving a talk at, it was the Department of Nuclear Physics at the main science university in Budapest, Hungary, in Europe. And there were about 150 professors and graduate students of physics there, and I kind of went through this history, this hidden history of physics, because it's not just the Curies, there are other
yeah.
physicists who've also been involved in this kind of research. And I went through the cases with them, and then I was wondering, well, what are they going to say? So one of the physicists came up to me later, he's a very prominent physicist in Hungary, and he told me, yeah, I'm very glad that you gave this talk. He said, by day, I do plasma physics, you know, the physics of superheated gases. But he told me, privately, I'm doing some experiments of telepathy. I have my young son. I put him in another room, and I flip a coin, and he's got a guess. Is it heads or tails? And he said, my son is getting 80% correct.
Wow.
And he told me, I wouldn't speak about this to any of my colleagues. They think I've just gone completely off the ball,
yeah.
but... He said, I feel safe talking to you about it. And he asked me to put him in touch with some psychical researchers, which I agreed to do. But it's one thing I find is that many scientists, they may externally appear quite orthodox, you know, in their views. But if you scratch a little deeper, they are interested in these topics, but they may be a little bit afraid.
Well, professionally,
yeah.
and we hear that all the time.
Well, I
talk to tons of people that are, you know, in the same position.
Right, and yes, I talk to people, you know,
yeah.
oh, well, you know, I'm a businessman, I can't, but I have a ghost story for you.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
you know, how many...
A lot of people that are doing research, though, a lot of these people have heavy scientific background.
But it's good to hear that they're, you know, I mean, scientists, I mean, they're, hopefully, one of the things that got them into science was curiosity.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. See, I think... this kind of sort of intellectual dictatorship that's in power now, you know, that's that has so much control over scientific institutions and the education system,
mm-hmm.
is actually in a not in what I would call a very meta-stable condition. I think their position is a little bit precarious because, first of all, most people. Surveys have shown this. Gallup surveys,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of surveys have shown that most people, even in the so-called developed countries of the world, like the United States, actually believe in paranormal phenomena. I mean, that's been shown beyond a doubt. And many scientists themselves, they privately believe in it, although they're maybe a little bit intimidated by, you know, the intellectual dictatorship. And some of them, there are many who are kind of stepping outside the standard scientific institutions and are forming their own institutions to be able to carry out such research in different countries. You know, we have the Scientific and Medical Network in the United Kingdom, the Institute for Noetic Sciences in the United States, and other organizations like that. So I think eventually things are going to have to change at the top.
What's going on university-wise nowadays? Because
there are a few universities in Europe, in the Netherlands, United Kingdom, that have chairs of parapsychology.
Oh.
In this country, I think there was the University of North Carolina had a chair in parapsychology. I think it still does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it closed down recently. But there are some countries where they actually have chairs of parapsychology where they are doing active research and things like extrasensory perception and things of that sort. There are when I speak at universities in different countries around the world, I find tremendous interest in these topics. So it's really an interesting condition, and it's one I think that can't go on for a whole lot longer, where you have the establishment being dead set against these things and the people in general and many scientists themselves being interested in them. I don't think that can go on forever. I think eventually the leadership, is going to have to get more in harmony with what the societies that support them actually believe.
And have you been, you must have been through some of their work or research or talked to them, that kind of thing, in order to come up with, because the human devolution kind of thing is new to me. I see where it's going and where it's coming from. I haven't seen the evidence, but I think I get the gist. But it's kind of the same thing, though, from the other side with the primordial soup and a bunch of chemicals and a couple of atoms banging into each other, to say, okay, well, if we suppose the opposite, if we suppose that we are, consciousness, and
right.
Then all of a sudden some dust,
primary, not matter, yeah.
and then some dust or something got commingled, and boom, 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 and now we are just us, over time.
Just dust, but consciousness covered by a lot of dust.
yes, covered by a lot of dust. But first of all, it's brilliant. When did it, was this an epiphany that you had while going through these things, or did you just like connect dots because this is brilliant?
When I was in my 20s, I decided I want to set out on my own personal voyage of self-discovery and exploration, and that took me to many countries around the world, to many different philosophies of life, and what finally attracted me was the spiritual philosophy of ancient India, and I began a practice of meditation and yoga, a form of yoga called bhakti yoga, and started studying the ancient Sanskrit writings, and that's what led me to a lot of these ideas. And then I had to decide, well, this is so different from anything that I have been taught when I was in high school, when I was in the university, that I absorbed from the leaders of our modern Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to think, well, what am I going to do? I mean, one thing is I could have just forgotten the world and just gone off by myself to just absorb myself in my meditations. But I decided, no, I didn't want to do that. I thought, let me try to translate these insights into the language of Western philosophy and science and popular culture, because I thought there would be something, some value in doing that. Now, when I started actually looking deeply into these things, I found that if you actually look at the history of Western science, the history of Western philosophy, you'll find that this very strict materialism that is now dominant, which that is something very recent. If you go back in time to the time of Newton and to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, back before that to the time of the Greeks and Romans, you'll see that they had this idea, many of the ideas that I talk about in my book Human Devolution, namely that a human being is not just a combination of chemicals, that human beings are a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness.
Yeah.
That we inhabit a multi-level cosmos that is inhabited by different kinds of beings existing on the different levels. Now, you know, we exist on the level of ordinary matter, where our consciousness and mind are covered by ordinary matter. But beyond that, there's a level of subtle mental energies, I would say, inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. And people down through the ages have had different names for them. They've called them astral beings, gods, goddesses, angels, gene, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say, beyond that, you know, there's a level of pure consciousness or spirit, which is our original source. But this idea, although it's found in many ancient wisdom traditions, like the Vedic tradition of India, Chinese wisdom, Egyptian wisdom, it's found in the Australian Aboriginals, Native American peoples, Pacific Islanders. They all have this idea.
So this is something similar through all these different cultures, you're saying?
Right. And it's something that was also present in the West in science, philosophy, and up until just about two or three centuries ago. Then it started disappearing.
Well, that's when they started having to apply for grants from the foundations in order to do their research, in order to publish, and they had to, you know, write their, you know, their statements and
I think what they found, I think you're right, and scientists wanted to have social value. They wanted to be supported, you know, by their governments, by their societies. They want to be valued. And they found that if they just concentrated on matter, how it operates, how it's controlled, how you can make different technologies, there was a tremendous result from that. You know, when the very first scientific institution was formed, the Royal Institution in London back in the 17th century or 16th century, I think it was 17th century, they decided, we're not going to deal with all this alchemy and paranormal stuff and spiritualist stuff. We're just going to focus on ordinary matter and how we can understand, measure, control it, predict it, make technologies based on it. Because the other stuff was just too wild, you know. And so they decided to focus on, and that was in one sense a good decision, because as a result of that focus, just not on subtle matter and vital principles and higher beings and all that stuff, just by focusing on ordinary matter and that you could measure, control, do laboratory experiments with, that was very productive for science in the sense that they were able to gain a lot of understanding of how ordinary matter works and how to make interesting things from it. Of course, we have to see what the result of that has been. It's that all these, most of the inventions have been in the area of weapons of mass destruction, dangerous kinds of drugs, and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have all these great ways to kill people.
It was productive in one sense, but it created so many problems. The environmental crisis, war.
It's creating problems right now as we speak.
But so is us not going to break. Yeah. So what we have to do is, I want to go to break real
quick.
Thank you. I want to go to break real quick, and I want people to think about this. What if somebody along the lines had said, instead of, you know, we want to concentrate on you know, atoms and molecules and energies, what if electricity kind of energy, what if they had decided we want to concentrate on the spiritual being and the mental powers? Wow.
It'd be a different world.
It'd be a completely different world. Ponder that while we take a quick break.
Just stay with us. Let's take a break.
Yeah. Play that break so we can
get
Welcome to Paranormal News on Ghostly Talk Radio. Paranormal News is produced by Genesis Creations Entertainment. I'm your host, Bonnie Vance. Our first story comes from the Metro in the UK. Is Heath Ledger still hanging around? Actress Michelle Williams claims to have been visited by Heath Ledger's spirit. She told friends that Heath Ledger, who died of an accidental drug overdose in January, had twice visited her as a shadowy apparition. The first time, she was awoken at night after hearing furniture move. In another visitation, he had apologized to her for not being there to help raise their 2-year-old daughter, Matilda. Michelle Williams claims the visits have helped her grieve. I have a special note on this article. As most of you know, I am a medium. I did receive some information about Heath Ledger on January 23, 2008. Now that this has gone public, I've decided to contact Michelle Williams' publicist and come forward with the information that I have. Michelle Williams is not alone in seeing Heath Ledger. I completely believe her. Some people say this is a publicity stunt, and I completely disagree. I think this is completely legitimate. I have my own experience with this. Our next story actually comes from the New York Times. I love it when we hit mainstream. It's called The Librarians Call It an Anomaly. It appears as a meandering shadow in the suspense section of the Elting Memorial Library, pausing on white plank floors in front of a bookcase with titles like Night Call from a Distant Time Zone, A Gathering of Ghosts, and Still Among the Living. Was it a spirit looking for something to read in the middle of the night? A surveillance tape picked up the image about a week before Halloween, and the mystery has deepened ever since. The video, called Ghost in the New Paltz Library, has been viewed on YouTube by thousands, while library employees and patrons continue to debate the possibilities and recount the coincidences. Not only was it almost Halloween, not only did the anomaly, as the library officials call the shadow, appear in the oldest part of the building, where shelves are filled with ghost stories, but the library had also erected a temporary altar used in celebrating the Day of the Dead in Mexico. While checking surveillance tape, a weird squiggle was discovered on the screen. The timestamp reads 3:30 a.m. as a gray smudge moves jerkily from the staircase over to the shelves and then disappears right through the wall. To read the full story and check out the surveillance footage, go to www.sdparanormal.com, Paranormal News feed page, and look for The Librarians Call It an Anomaly. Our last story comes from Como TV in San Francisco. Federal Way women claim sexual assault by, get this, a ghost. Wow, is that safe sex or what? According to a police report, two women told officers a paranormal person had been placing sensors on their bodies and having intercourse with them at their apartment. Here's an audio clip.
All right, this is definitely the weirdest crime blotter story we've ever seen. Two Federal Way women claim they've been sexually attacked. Are you ready for this? By ghosts. Como 4's Elisa Jaffe went to see if it's a crime or a crock.
In the Federal Way Mirror, yep, you read it right, two women report ghosts having sex with them. According to this police report, the women came here to the Federal Way Police Station and told officers that a paranormal person has been placing sensors on their bodies and having intercourse with them. Police declined comment on the report. An odd case for cops and reporters.
I believe there's something out there.
But it's right up Ross Allison's alley. He's a ghost hunter. We met him at the apartment where the women say a spirit has haunted them for 2 years.
Cases like that don't pop up that often.
Well, if you look, his other leg appears to still be there and not move, while these colors do.
With the Sci-Fi Channel hit Ghost Hunters, paranormal popularity is soaring. And Allison says as the number of ghost shows grows, so do spirit sightings.
And so they start to label every little interesting thing happening in their home as paranormal activity.
When it might be
just the house creaking.
Candid questions help ghost hunters sort the eerie from the unstable.
A lot of times you'll find that it could be medications that they're taking or something that's psychological.
The maintenance man in charge of all these units told me the women keep calling him saying the ghosts are raping them on weekend nights. He told them to call police. Police tell me they don't have any investigative leads. Ross Allison says he'd need a psychic to check. And the women, well, they weren't anywhere to be found. Just like the ghost. In Federal Way, Elisa Jaffe, Como 4 News.
For more information on these stories, please go to www.sdparanormal.com and the Paranormal News feed page. Don't forget, sign up for a free subscription to Paranormal News. Thanks for joining us today on Paranormal News. If you'd like to sponsor or advertise on Paranormal News, please send us an email at parxnews@aol.com. You can listen to Paranormal News on Ghostly Talk Radio at www.ghostlytalk.com. Please check out their other fine shows. Or you can join us at paranormalnews.mypodcast.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Bonnie Vent.
Hey, Scott O. I just want to thank you for this sweet Ghostly Talk t-shirt, man. When I put it on, women just start coming at me from all directions.
Well, no problem, dude.
Oh, yeah, and check this out. I had this rash in my chest for like 3 months, right? The first time I wore this Ghostly Talk t-shirt for the day, I took it off before bed and the rash was gone.
Really?
Yeah, dude. I also worked at a job interview I had last week, and not only did I get the job, but the boss liked it so much, he made me his partner.
Huh?
Yeah, and I'm now a millionaire because of your Ghostly Talk t-shirts.
Well, you know, we not only have new t-shirts for 2007, but Ghostly Talk also has a brand new line of bumper stickers and 1¼-inch buttons.
You're kidding!
No, sir. You can check them out and also find out how to order them at ghostlytalk.com.
I must go and order all of them now!
Whoa, hold on. Save some for the rest of the listeners. As you can see, Ghostly Talk swag is going fast, so head on over to ghostlytalk.com and check it out. T-shirts, bumper stickers, and 1¼-inch buttons, all for a very cheap price. Order yours today.
The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, television is reality, and reality is less than television.
One thing I want to point out real, I want to mention this. We didn't mention this in the first half an hour of the show.
Yeah.
Allie and Tanya, our dear friends from southern Indiana, they did have to take off early last night because Tanya's mom had a stroke. She was not, and she's been very sick. I actually just talked to Allie while we were on the break for a minute. She called me actually during the show, and I called her back. And their mom is going to have to go in for surgery this week. She's up and walking around, though. So we just wanted to send out, you know, send some good vibes over their way to Tanya's mom for a speedy recovery. They're very, very, very good friends of ours, and we were really bummed out they had to leave, but, you know, family always comes first, even with Ghostly Talk here. This is Ghostly Talk, by the way. I'm Scott Allen.
And I'm Doug.
And I'm Bonnie.
And before we went to break, We were talking with the brilliant Michael Cremo, of course, who's, I hope, still here with us. and you actually...
Still here.
Okay.
Yay.
You kind of raised an interesting question, Doug, so I'm going to give you the floor.
Yeah. Well, first, the website is www.mcremo.com. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's also permanently linked up at girlswhotalk.com, because we've talked with Michael before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they had sort of somewhat arbitrarily, although I have a... Because, in you know, back in the day... the people were studying not only matter and gravity and, you know, the things that we're familiar with as science,
mm-hmm.
but people were also studying what now is thought of as kind of pseudoscience,
yeah.
in that, you know, ESP, telepathy, the telekinesis and all that stuff like the Curies were doing, right? So people were doing both, and they somewhat arbitrarily they must have said
there was a fork in the road. There was a fork in the road.
Yeah,
somewhere.
And they go, you know what? We're going to establish this, and we're going to study these, and we're going to study them really, really hard and long, and they did, because we've got computers now, and we have satellites in space, and mm-hmm. we have 500 channels on our televisions, and so they got that down really, really good.
Yeah,
you know, but we're still, I think, at the very, very, very beginnings mm-hmm. of the more esoteric sciences, the science of the
science of the mind, more or less,
of the mind and of the being.
There is psychology, Michael, of course, and people do study the mind, but I don't think people really study the consciousness and the spirituality side of this thing.
Well, psychology. You know, if you study the name, you know, the name psychology, it comes from the Greek word psyche, which means soul.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one famous historian who said, first psychology lost its soul, then it lost its mind.
Yeah, I've heard that before. And that's very true.
Yeah, what's amazing with psychology, that's not the only thing where it is, because psychologists are, I think, sometimes making mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think that's even changed, Michael, a little bit. I think that psychologists and psychiatrists and things are, you know, people who deal with that stuff that you can't, you know, mold into a computer chip. I think that they're also suffering from curiosity as well and getting out there.
They absolutely are. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was an anthropologist named Catherine Ewing, you know, from University of North Carolina. And I mentioned her case in my book, Human Devolution, but she went to Pakistan to do a study of Sufi mystics. And she was just doing it, you know, according to her scientific rationale. And you know, she was interviewing a Sufi mystic, and he said to her, well, I don't think you really believe what I'm saying. You know, he said, tonight I am going to appear to you. In your dreams, I'm going to appear to you in a, you know, like a spiritual form that you're just not going to be able to deny. Mm-hmm. All right, so she went back to the place where she was staying, and then she went to sleep. She went into very, very deep sleep, and then just this man, the Sufi mystic, just appeared to her in a very, you know, brilliant form in the middle of the dream, and she just woke up in a start, you know, like, and she said, she wrote in an article that was published in the Scientific Anthropology Journal, she said, I woke up and I started to try to fit this in to my normal scientific framework, you know, some kind of dream, suggestion, this or that. She said, finally, I just couldn't do it. So why can't I just believe that this Sufi mystic appeared to me just as he said he was going to do? And she said, why in science do we have to rule out all these possibilities right from the beginning? And I think that's the way that many scientists are going these days. They're starting to see that you really can't rule out all of these things, because that isn't, I mean, say, if in science you just rule out the possibility of mystical experiences, telepathy, telekinesis, all this stuff, right from the start, then that means your science might not be dealing with everything that's possibly true about the world. And I think science should be open to everything that is actually possibly true about the world that we live in. That's real science. To deny in advance, a priori, all these things, I think is not real science. That's an ideology of some kind.
And we hear that, I mean, I know this field we study in here, obviously, the stuff that we do with the show and with ourselves, we hear, we see and hear, you know, walls being put up every day to a lot of things. You know, and a lot of times, just last weekend, Andrew Nichols was on the show, mm-hmm. and he literally said, look, you know, as far as EVP research is concerned, he's like, look, this is old hat, we did this 20 years ago. We ruled it out 20 years ago. And I just talked to, you know, Kenny from Pyra, for example. We were talking about this over the weekend when we were doing the film stuff. And he's like, you know, I like that guy. He's like, how can he be just so, like, boom, shut your mouth. It's old hat. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And that's an ideology itself is like, okay, you know, why can't we just keep working on this
Well,
thing,
to be
know?
Fair, I mean, Andrew Nichols was talking on an hour long segment of a program. And
I'm not misquoting the guy. I mean,
no, but he's trying to advance his thing that, you know, what we need to start from what's already known.
Yeah.
And that's actually, that applies here, Michael. Somebody needs to teach folks their, like a crash course or something has to be done, I would think, for scientists who are into this. You said you were approached by a fellow on one of your trips, and he says, you know, I just have my son in another room, and then I flip a coin, you know, and he's getting great results, and he's mystified by a physicist, I think, and he's mystified, and he wanted to know who else is doing this kind of thing. Well, those kind of experiments have been done in I know, university laboratories, in institutes and things like that here in the United States, and I know in England, so those have been done for years and years. So there's got to be some kind of basis, a platform on which to build and advance from.
Yeah.
But nobody knows.
We keep reinventing the wheel.
As long as you're shrouded and not wanting anyone to see or know what you're doing, you're not communicating with others or learning the basics and then moving from the basics on. Everybody's relearning the basics and noticing them on their own.
Yeah.
Catherine did, the physicist did. So I think maybe communication might help advance these sciences. And your book, of course, is if you cover all this stuff, you've got it there. Mm-hmm. You're like, just read this book, and you know,
it's like, I don't consider myself to be like an original sort of paranormal researcher, maybe like you are, but what I tried to do was
far from that.
Put all the different kinds of research into some kind of framework where it makes sense as a worldview, you know, which is, I think it's something that's necessary to try to tie all these things together, see how they all fit together. But and I think there are some, I'm not an organization builder myself, but I do admire those who are putting together organizations that, you know, like the Scientific and Medical Network, the Institute for Noetic Studies, and others, you know, others around the world that are, I think, trying to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Well, what you just said, Michael, you know, in your book, Human Evolution, you're trying to, and we talked about this before the break too, that there are all these similarities with all, you know, with all these different belief systems all over the world. And you just mentioned this again, this came up again, trying to tie these things together. And this is something I know that both Doug and myself have shared as far as an opinion with all this. You know, if you want to just take all this weird stuff going on, you know, we talk about a lot of ghost stories here on this show, talk about UFO stuff on this show, even, you know, cryptozoology and all these weird things, right? And we, I think, you know, we're trying to focus more on the same thing you are, too, where we're trying to tie these things together and go, I think there is some type of glue between all these things that while this weird stuff happens.
Well, for example, I mean, just let's take ghosts. I mean, how I would explain that is that a human being is composed of three things, an original conscious self, a subtle mental body, and a gross physical body. You can almost compare it to like computer user, computer software, computer hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happens in some cases is that if somebody is removed from their physical body, their gross physical body in a certain way, that it's very difficult for them to get another one, then they would remain as a ghost. in the subtle mental body, which has its own senses and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they may remain like that, and they may reveal themselves in terms of apparitions, where they appear to living humans, or they may, through their subtle bodies, be able to control the subtle bodies of embodied humans, and then you have cases of possession.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are ways to tie, you know, these different kinds of phenomena together.
Yeah.
And this idea of a subtle mental body that extends beyond the gross physical body, even because normally we channel our subtle senses, I would say, through the physical organs of the body. You know, the subtle visual sense is channeled through the eye. But there are some people who are able to take the visual sense out of that channel and engage in things like remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would say the reason they're able to do that is that the visual sense is not confined to the fleshy globes that are in the holes in our, you know, front part of our skull.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a subtle visual sense that's part of the mental body that extends beyond it.
Right.
I think there are scientists and researchers working on these things. Yeah, I was at a conference a couple of years ago in Montreal where I met Stephen Schwartz. Have you ever had him on one of your shows?
No,
he
we
was
haven't.
He is one of the people who was part of the Stanford Research Institute when it was contracted by the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, to do remote viewing for the CIA, military intelligence, and organizations like that. And that's an admitted fact. I mean, that's an admitted fact.
Oh, yeah.
The government in the 1970s spent $20 million. And who knows what they're doing today? I mean, but it was interesting. Like, he had a work. He has done some very interesting things, but he had a workshop in remote viewing. And he said, actually, this is an ability that we all have. And, you know, I went to the workshop. And there were about 100 of us there. And what he did was pretty interesting. He took three people, and he told them, get in a taxi, go anywhere you want in Montreal, and take this video camera with you, film the place that you go to, and then try to mentally send the image back here. So they went out, and the remainder of us just were sitting there, and we got some instructions how to react to whatever mental imagery it was that we were getting. We were told, well, don't question it, just whatever comes, put it down. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And sitting next to me was Rupert Sheldrake, who's another researcher in this field, you know, who's engaged in what he calls morphogenetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
But I sat there, I thought, okay, the first image that came into my mind was red glass candles with little flames, you know, glowing in them. And I rejected it. I thought, I was convinced they'd gone to a bowling alley. That's where I thought they'd gone. You know, but all right, so I thought, okay, let me just put this down. And they were sort of guided. Stephen Schwartz was kind of guiding us, you know, what do you see when you look up, what do you see when you look down, to the left, to the right, to the front, to the back, if you were to rise 20 feet in the air, what would you see? And I went through the exercise with him, and I was really amazed when the people came back. You know, they put the videotape into the machine, the first image that came up was these red candles, you know, like,
whoa.
I was just blown away myself. And I'd pretty much gotten it right. Rupert Sheldrake, who was sitting next to me, also pretty much got it right. They had gone to a cathedral somewhere.
Oh.
And most people, about 60% or 70% of the people, had gotten the idea that they were in some kind of religious structure. But, you know, like, I was just amazed when the very first image, you know, that they projected, you know, from the video camera, you know, that they'd taken with them, you know, was the same image that I'd gotten. You know,
and rejected.
That was pretty amazing. and apparently, you know, he's done these things a lot. So there is a body of evidence there, you know, that most people do possess, you know, this remote viewing power.
Yeah.
But because we're just so absorbed in all the media, you know, the television, the radio, the computers, and we're normally just conditioned to accept the imagery that comes through our the physical organs of our eyes, we're not really aware of it.
We've done a work in remote view. We've done a lot of remote viewing work here on the show too, and I can actually concur with you on that. I mean, we've done double blind experiments where, you know, with a group of people who have, you know, have done their session work, and I've taken part in this myself. This is just coming from it, myself, and I've gotten some pretty interesting results myself from remote viewing too. So I do have experience in that, and it is quite a charge to see, like, hey, I'm right. How'd I get that? You know?
Yeah. But so, what does it mean in terms of our whole worldview? To me, what it suggests is there's more to a human being than chemical.
Yes.
That we have a subtle body, a subtle mental body with extrasensory powers, powers of mind over matter, and then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist apart from that. There's evidence for that in terms of out-of-body experiences, past life memories, and things like that. There's a body of scientific evidence that suggests that we are conscious selves. We didn't evolve up from matter, because most scientists today think, well, consciousness of mind are phenomena that arise temporarily when you organize chemicals at a certain level of complexity. Then you get these evanescent things we call mind and consciousness.
Yeah.
And if you disorganize the chemicals, disorganize the matter, then no more consciousness, no more mind. I think it's the opposite. They want to say matter is primary. I'm saying no, consciousness is the primary thing. It can become covered and limited.
it's true though. I just like last week or maybe the week before was telling somebody that my own view of how things work is, you know, because somebody was asking what happens after we die, because, you know, I guess I, you know, co-host a radio show about ghosts, and so they so he says, what do you think happens when we die? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm gonna, you know, essentially go home, and not necessarily in a religious sense, but I'm gonna go, you know, be back with my you know, my energy.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm just a little,
that subtle body you're,
I'm a little
about,
tiny
Michael.
Bit of myself, and myself is up there or over there or wherever we are. And that right now, I'm limited. I'm severely limited. I don't remember anything. I don't, you know, I mean, I'm limited by the chemicals that I'm currently borrowing right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really believe that. And I'm also limited by time.
Yeah,
because right now is the top of the hour.
What a bummer.
And I don't like that. Your website, www.mcremo.com.
Nice segue, by the way.
And the book, Human Devolution. Wow, Michael. Good work.
It's always great to have you on the show, Michael. Thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was great being with you and all your listeners.
And teaching us and letting us learn, because we do learn when we talk to you.
Oh, yeah.
Hang on the line for 1 second. Don't leave us just yet, okay, Michael?
Okay.
We're going to go to break here. Coming up, who do we have coming up, Doug?
We have, of course, of course.
Of course. Of course, the horse, the horse, the horse. My name is Doug Simig. Very nice, Doug.
I'm done. We have Heather Lambert coming up.
We'll be right back after Doug figures out what's wrong with his tongue.
Miss a live broadcast? Feel free to download it direct from the on-demand archives at ghostlytalk.com.